Welcome to Day 2 Cloud, part of the Packet Pushers family of podcasts. You know, we've talked a lot about automation on Day 2 Cloud, and that's largely been at a theoretical level. This week, we got a chance to sit down with Mr. Larry Smith and talk about his philosophy on automation, but also get into the guts of some real-world examples, especially when it comes to building out consistent and reliable builds for VMs across multiple cloud providers and your on-premises. Ethan, what struck you about the conversation?
You know, Larry told us about 5 years worth of work he's done on an automation platform. And the biggest question that came up in my mind as he was building this one particular system is, how the heck does Larry not become the end all and the be all of this thing where no one can make a move or use the system without Larry's involvement? And we ended up talking quite a lot about that on this show, which I feel was one of the most important things to get out, so that we don't reinvent that bottleneck of the one star that does all the things and has to be involved in all the processes. And it just screws up the business, because when that one person is not available, then there's problems. So we talk about that at length with Larry along the way. And I that was a highlight for me, Ned.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. Being able to shed some of the technical debt and also not create a whole bunch more and be the bottleneck on everything, that's hugely important, and we definitely dig into that. So enjoy this episode of Day 2 Cloud with Mr. Larry Smith, Senior DevOps Engineer for Business Technology Architects, the expert and all-around awesome dude from the ATL. Larry is going to be our automation guide, our Sherpa. So keep your arms and legs inside the ride at all times. Larry, say hi to the nice people out there.
Hey, everybody. Great job, Ned, for setting me up for failure right from the start. Great job. Great job.
You'll be nothing but successful, I'm certain. Do you want to tell the folks maybe just a little bit about yourself? Not your whole life story, but just who are you? What do you do? That sort of thing.
Yeah. So as Ned said, my name is Larry Smith. I'm based out of Atlanta. You can find me on Twitter at Mr. L.E. Smith Jr. I occasionally blog about once a year anymore at everythingshouldbevirtual.com. My main presence is probably on GitHub, where you can find a huge amount of stuff that I may be working on or have put out for consumption from an automation perspective or some other fashion. I am a senior DevOps engineer. I currently work at BTA, which is Business Technology Architects. We're based out of Atlanta. We're a consulting firm that generally works in the Cisco space, but also from an automation perspective, we do some automation goodness as well. So I've, real quick, to not go into the whole story, my automation background goes back about 5 years now from a true automation perspective. We'll leave it at that.
It's interesting you say a true automation perspective. I feel like, every talk or every conference that I go to, everything that I attend, I'm always like being beaten over the head by automation, automation, that everything should be automated. And like, I agree with that, but sometimes people are a little vague about what they mean when they say automation. So when you say true automation, what does that mean to you?
That's a great question, because you're right. Every conversation that is talking about automation is very gray, if you will. It's not very, what do you automate? So when I say true automation, I'm talking about, I don't just automate, let's say we're standing up an Apache web server and Nginx. That's an application. Yes, I'm going to automate it. When I'm talking about true automation, I'm talking about, let's talk full stack automation. Let's talk about rolling racks into a data center with zero touch. To agree, obviously can automate that roll in of racks, but you know what I'm saying. Roll it in and do complete provisioning from network all the way to, let's say, microservices running, as well as testing, spinning up 10,000 pods or 10,000 containers and testing throughout an environment. So that includes all of the components that are provisioned along the way. So that's what I get at when I'm talking about whole infrastructure.
Okay. So not just deploying the application and saying, oh, I've automated it because I can run a package manager from a script. This is more, I'm doing the full stack of automation from when the physical gear gets connected all the way to when the applications are launched. And I you mentioned testing in there. So how important is the testing portion of automation?
I mean, as we all would say, it's very important. It's very critical. You know, ironically, we're on day two cloud. So we'll talk about what that means for not just day zero. You know, the testing that I'm talking about is, you know, obviously you get into day zero, you're provisioning the whole infrastructure, building it up. And then part of that is your testing. So you define what your testing should check and also randomize it. So you're not always checking the same thing. So maybe you're testing containers across pods or across data centers, for example. You might want to put in your testing to be able to inject a failure to make sure that your HA is working, maybe across the data center. So maybe you're using like a console cluster from HashiCorp. You want to ensure that that stuff is available in the other data centers. And we'll talk more about that when we get into the real day two. How do we not just address day zero, but also the ongoing life cycle of the automation? So I'll leave it at that for now.
Larry, I got to ask you more about this true automation idea where you're
talking about. Did I set myself up for failure right from the start on this?
So here's what I want you to qualify. So you talked about true automation and what that really means being everything, not just I'm going to stand up a server, but all of it. Roll a rack into the data center, and by the time it's all done, everything's been provisioned. You're serving up maybe 10,000 applications on this rack. Okay. Most of the products that are out there that I can think of that might fit into that space are commercial. They're some kind of a vendor product. They're quite specific and narrowly focused, or tend to be. But you've built something yourself. Is that all like you cobbled together a bunch of open source stuff, wrote some glue code, and over 5 years have evolved this into some kind of a system?
Yes. So that's what everything that I use from an automation perspective is open source. So anybody that knows kind of my background from an automation perspective knows I'm very heavy in Ansible. I don't always rely on Ansible because it's not always the right tool for their job, right? Mm. So it depends on what stage in the provisioning you might be in. For example, when you roll in a rack after you provision a network, doing some ZTP, zero touch provisioning, maybe laying down different operating system on some Dell switches or something like that. You may use Ansible for that, but you also have to account for what does that infrastructure need to be in place in order to actually do that automation from the beginning. Because when you're talking about you want hands off from the beginning, you might have to rely on other tooling, right? You might have to have maybe some Python code, maybe some shell scripts. But being able to identify the tool for the job makes it a lot more agnostic to some degree, but you also don't want a bunch of tools that you have to support long term, right? So you don't want to say I'm doing PowerShell for this, I'm doing shell scripts for that, I'm using batch files for that, using Ansible, I'm using Chef, etc. Have a defined, like maybe your Ansible is your tool of choice, that's first choice, and then say maybe if that doesn't fit the bill, augment it with some Python, and then if that doesn't fit the bill, do something else. So for example, building out the network gear, do a thing. Now you're getting into actually provisioning actual physical servers. So you've got a rack of servers or multiple racks of servers. For example, you might use Moss or RackN or something like that for your provisioning. You need to have the ability to tap into those APIs. So you probably are going to be writing custom code. So you're going to write Python code, more than less. Write some Python code that will actually talk to those APIs after those services are provisioned as well. So I don't know if that answered your question, Ethan. It's yes, it's all open source. Yeah.
it definitely answers the question, Larry, but it does introduce another question. So if I'm the average company, I would look to my vendor to solve this problem for me because I don't want to build all of this in-house technical debt, or at least that's an argument that I could make. So talk about that. I mean, you've incurred lots of technical debt because of the magic that you've woven together in the form of open source and scripts and so on to build this automation platform, it sounds like. How do you deal with that? How does your company deal with that?
So one of the things that you do is, number one, from the beginning, you have to adopt version control, right? You have to have some sort of version control in place where all of the code exists. This is not, you know, emailing Excel spreadsheets around the company and doing all this other crap. We'll take those Excel spreadsheets and actually convert them to code, because then we have a data model or data structure that we can work within. But take those elements, put them into version control, and then on top of that, you start leveraging pipelines, right? So you version or the version control. So for example, GitLab. I may use GitLab CI. Put all of those moving parts are in code at that point. If you look at the pipeline, you know exactly what's executing. Now, to the technical debt, that is the ongoing care and feeding of those specific components that are required to do the provisioning. Now, I can say probably 75% of the time, if I'm working with Ansible, it may not be the fastest tool, but it's the most flexible. From a not only a start to finish perspective, but as a learning experience, it's a lot easier for someone to pick up Ansible than say Puppet or Chef. Now, somebody that's very fluent in Puppet and Chef may disagree. Just from my perspective over the years, as I dabbled in all these different automation frameworks, the Ansible one was a little bit more digestible. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. When you're describing that you've put a system together with a pipeline and with tooling that gets everybody on board. In other words, the technical debt doesn't live with Larry.
Exactly.
You're not the guy, who was it, Brent in the Phoenix Project? You're not that guy just with a new set of tools. You've actually built a system that everyone is involved with.
Yes.
There's a standard way to deploy it, to work on it. That engages the team at large. So at some point you walk away and people are going to notice that Larry walked away, but that's fine. You know, everything's there. There's a pipeline and there's a structure and a process and people know how to use the tools and update the tools and, and so on.
And you actually hit on a good point is the structure is the very on top of the version control, the structure in which you do it is very, very, very important, right? Because you want that structure to be consistent across all of the different moving parts. So you want common, maybe even data structure, meaning folders, directories, everything that's within a repository, have a common structure, which also includes the documentation that goes along with that. I know as technical people, we don't, now we're bloggers, we like to write more than normal, but generally, as I'm typing up, like doing the code for a thing, I'm also at the same time augmenting that with the documentation that says, hey, if you do this, this is what the outcome will be. Or here's why this is there. But also within the code, being able to write notes and comments within the code so somebody else, as Larry steps away, can come in and say, what the hell was he doing, right?
Oh, Larry, we were talking before the show about this PHP I've been dabbling with in this custom WordPress site, and that is everything that this code is not. It, other than there are some somewhat intuitively named variables, there are no comments to speak of. It's like a mystery. Every line's a hunt to try to figure out what the heck it does.
Yeah, and I mean, you're right. I mean, that's, you know, and Ned, hopefully I didn't cut you off because, you know, I do like to talk. So. but not only the note and being able to make sure that it's consumable by others, always testing. So one of those things that that I'm very big on and, you know, massive project that I worked on years ago, one of the things was multiple data centers, deployments, et cetera, kind of what I was talking about a moment ago. About spinning up the whole infrastructure, you don't just do it once. You do it once, twice a week. and it's sporadic. And what I mean by that is we would come into the environment, we would come into work, and we would have basically our project manager that was in charge of the whole project would say, we're going to tear down the site in Dallas, or we're going to tear the site down in Miami, or we're going to tear the site down in Atlanta. And you didn't know when it was going to happen or where it was going to be. And what that did was ensure that, number one, you had failover, because the whole idea was we don't work after hours. We work during the day when people are actually consuming the services. So when you come in and you say, we're going to tear down a data center, you don't tell anybody. You tear it down like you just had a DR scenario and make sure that all of those components fail over. Once you identify by doing that over and over and over, you start fine-tuning that process, right? You start fine-tuning the code. You say, okay, that was relevant then. This is no longer relevant. Let's streamline that and make it a little bit more concise and be able to actually alleviate as much technical debt as possible, if you will. But not only that, you identify those gaps in your DR, HA type things, because if you're not telling anybody and they say, hey, why did the service go down? Well, we know why. Let's figure out why it did that and make sure that we can add that logic to the pipeline of automation.
Contextually, Larry, we've been talking more about our on-premises infrastructure, I think, or it's felt that way to me, but this is day two cloud. So let's take these automation ideas and the way you're doing automation to a cloud environment. Because for most people, cloud was very disruptive, right? A big shift operationally, big shift technically, assuming they were trying to do it right and not just lift and shift.
Yep.
So how does automation play a role in doing cloud right, not just, you know, adding another data center?
Right. So one of the things that I like to do when I get into working on an automation project is, number one, working with everybody, get them on the same page. And what your goal is to be as agnostic to the environment in which you're doing the automation or provisioning to allow you to move components in and out. So as you said, we're talking about on-prem. So if we're doing on-prem, that process should facilitate moving to the cloud, because all you're doing is saying, hey, now, instead of in the data center, all of these services that need to be spun up and be running and testing and validating, now run in the cloud. So what you do is you start looking at it from an agnostic perspective, saying, okay, if the scenario is this, I take this path. If the scenario is that, I take this other path, right? Same could be said for, maybe I'm doing container platforms today, but maybe I want to roll in OpenStack. What is the minimal amount of effort that I would need in order to facilitate that new technology? So I could say, in my pipeline, I might be as simple as I define a variable in my pipeline. My pipeline could say, I can go to on-prem. I can go to the cloud. I can also say, today I'm containers. Tomorrow I'm OpenStack. And in your pipeline, it could be literally a switch of a bit that says, I'm making this determination on where it goes and everything else follows. That is a very hard concept to not only implement, but also to get that level of abstraction absorbed. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it sounds very much like how a programmer would approach a problem.
Yes. Yes.
Because I come from
a programming background. So
well, there you go.
Yeah.
Because when I think about abstractions and taking the essence of something and abstracting that out and then having various use cases, it's almost like a type system. If you're doing like object oriented programming and you have like a higher level type, say maybe a vehicle type, and then a subtype that inherits the properties of vehicle, but now you have your car and your truck and your, I don't know, Zamboni.
And exactly.
That has its own, obviously its own specific properties that are associated with it, but it's inheriting properties from its parent object.
Yes.
And so it sounds like what you're, and correct me if I'm wrong, it sounds like what you're kind of saying is take the abstraction of the data center or the cloud. That's your high-level construct.
Yep.
But then you're going to have things like AWS or Azure or your own private cloud that inherit the properties from that higher-level construct. But now you're going to have additional properties that are specific to that particular cloud or data center. Is that kind of, that's where you're
absolutely
going with
right. You're absolutely right. And that's one of the things that I'd like to really talk about when we start talking about abstractions of automation is everything is an object, right? It doesn't matter if it's a data center. It doesn't matter if it's a rack. It doesn't matter if it's a server. It doesn't matter if it's a VM. It doesn't matter if it's a container. It doesn't matter if it's a Kubernetes pod. You know, it doesn't matter what it is. It's an object. It's just an object that I'm going to manipulate in some fashion. And being able to abstract all of those elements up as far as possible allows you to add your if, then, and else type flow, right? If I do this, if this element exists, then I take this path. If this element exists, I take this other path. Eventually, some of those things come back together because you don't want to duplicate the same work. But you want to facilitate all those scenarios and be able to account for anything that may be coming in the future as well. So it is a very, very different way, I think, in looking at automation. And it goes back to what I say, like real automation, right? Any automation is great. Don't get me wrong. But I what I'm really trying to express is that this is a whole different level of automation, right? This is, it's not opinionated. It's very object oriented. So it is like programming. And I made the comment that I, you know, early in my career, when I started college, never finished, I actually was computer science. So I was actually at one point writing my own operating system prior to getting exposed to Linux. And, you know, kind of looking at those things from a programming perspective. And at that time, I was like, no, I don't want to do this anymore. So I went down the infrastructure path. And then as I went down the infrastructure path, I always still approached everything from a programmatic perspective on how do you take all these components, stitch them together as objects, but also at the same time, make sure that you are not leaving technical debt. Now, one would go into an environment and say he left a ton of technical debt, right? But it's because they don't understand the constructs, right? So that's, it's very, it's a lot of fun, put it that way.
Yeah, certainly sounds like it. Aside from abstraction, so that is one fundamental piece of programming is being able to abstract things. What other elements of programming do you think have influenced your approach to automation and infrastructure?
I think the big things are, like we said, you know, about being able to look at things as objects, but also as being able to approach things in a structure, kind of going back to what we were talking about, having a structure that defines what you're doing, be them folders, directories, common things that are always available to you in, you know, documentation and things like that. But being able to also look at those things as being able to, I'm repeating myself, I know where I'm going, being able to abstract all those things, but being able to also teach others on how these work, but also don't do them on your own, right? And what I'm getting at is, yeah, Larry could come in and do this thing, but what Larry's going to do is come in and make sure it makes sense for everyone else, because what I will do is I will validate maybe a solution. When I approach things, I'm always looking at them from a solution perspective versus a one-off. I look at it as I'm going to do this thing. Maybe it's an automation or maybe I'm developing something. How does it play into all these other things and be able to start stitching those things together and then take them as a solution and present them as an option to get either A, the validation that yes, that would work, but maybe we could do it a little bit different. So you use those as engagements to get feedback and complete that feedback loop in order to ensure that everybody's on board with what the solution is. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Did I even answer your question?
I think you answered a different question that was equally interesting.
Yeah. So. My wife likes to tell me, you like to talk and you sidetrack a question by answering another question.
Oh, perhaps you should go into politics then.
Yeah, please maybe don't. So. I have time. I have time. How long do I have for the 2020?
I suppose.
Well, yeah, exactly.
When does it make sense to build versus buy? I guess that's probably what one of the fundamental questions is. You're working with all these open source technologies and you're really enjoying them personally. And I can see that you enjoy sharing that knowledge with others. But from a corporate perspective, they might look at it and be like, but we could just buy this thing that the vendor says does it. So where do you draw that line between building something yourself in-house versus finding a tool that already does it or a complete solution that already does it and just buying it?
That's the question that I always have to answer on my own, of course, because I, so for example, you might be putting a solution together. I'm going to use a real world example. Years ago, I was working in R&D with, hey, we've got this, let's say Dell NAS that is up for renewal, but we don't want to pay the money, right? Because it's old, you know, the same scenario.
Yeah.
We know you love playing in open source, and we know that NAS was built on a bunch of open source projects. I know you could throw something together. So I'm like, sure, let me throw it together. So I threw together a very highly scalable HA solution from a NAS perspective that would not only just provide file services, it was iSCSI for VMware or KVM, anything like that. NFS, if you wanted to use that as an export, and all these moving parts. And being able to validate and test, yes, performance looks good, et cetera, how much time have I invested in this? At the end of the day, getting to a point where like, yeah, we could do that, would save a lot of money. But the problem is I could go with Windows and get very similar functionality, pay a fee and be done with this in like 3 hours versus a week. And on top of that, if I were to make an exit, the supportability is much easier to say, well, I'm familiar with Windows and I can do this thing and I don't have to worry about all this other Linux-y stuff that maybe you put together. Yeah, sure, it's automated, but it will break. I can assure you that. So you have to be able to draw that line where it's like, yes, I can do it, but does it make sense for the business on whether this is the solution to go with long-term from a supportability perspective, or does it not? And those are the questions that are, they're sometimes challenging, right? Because everybody wants to save money. They're like, well, you did it. It should just work, right? It will break.
Yeah.
Don't call me if I'm not here. And don't call me if I am here at midnight when it breaks, because I'm not going to be the only one to support this. So,
well, it's the old problem of Larry needs to go on vacation. You know, even if you're not walking out the door, who wants a call when you're trying to take a break just because you're the only one that can figure this thing out when it, as you said, inevitably does break. Exactly. Again, we all face that in IT, no matter what level we're at. Okay, I'm staring at a router and I know if I put this somewhat esoteric feature in, it solves this particular problem, but it's so weird that no one's going to come in and be able to figure out what the heck that stupid thing does. And everyone's going to be scared to leave it in forever. It's not supportable long-term. It just isn't. Is there a better way to fix this problem that doesn't involve the esoteric feature? Or as you say, sometimes it does make sense, Larry, spend a few bucks. That's really the better answer for the business in the long haul. Yeah. Even though the business is only looking at dollars, that's every decision like that is actually bigger than simply a CapEx or or some kind of a small subscription fee that you got to pay to get this service. It's always more complicated than money, even though some managers seem to get comped on whether or not they saved a few bucks.
Exactly. And you're absolutely right. And, you know, kind of that foundation, which also leads into kind of the automation portion is, you know, being able to make sure that what you're doing does make sense back to the business, right? Kind of that philosophy, not only, I would say, does not come from a programming background, because if you're a diehard coder, you like to make work, right? If I can't, if to take it aside from that, I spent years, so I was at HP back in the late 90s into the 2000s. And one of the things that I did was not only internal consulting and things like that, was being able to develop solutions. And a lot of times it involved open source. But what I had to do, even if it wasn't open source, what I would have to do, part of what I needed to do, was validate a solution. Obviously, you need to know what you're trying to solve. Try to solve it. If you solve it, document it. And then part of that documentation in the flow was hand it off to the other tiers of support to ensure that they understood it and could duplicate the same solution. And then if it did go where they said, yeah, we're going to go this route, you never had to support it because everyone else was up to speed on what that solution's, the ins and outs of that solution. So it's a lot of different things that probably came together that got me in this weird place of how I approach automation. But they're all relevant, right?
It's funny, Larry, because going back earlier in the conversation, if you build the system right using, you know, pipelines, version control, and yeah, you know, awareness of common tooling, you're not this bottleneck in the system. You know, on the other hand, if you're the one that built it, you still kind of are. You never completely divorce yourself from that role.
Yeah, exactly. That's absolutely true. And that's the, you know, the whole thing where we start talking about mentoring and coaching and things like that is, sure, you might be able to put a solution together, but being able to actually have the conversations and coach and mentor and train others at the same time is a very valuable skill, right? I mean, we don't all hold them, and I'm not perfect by any means, but I like that. I actually like the human aspects more so than the technical aspects. So I do look at things from that angle as well as I'm going down these different avenues of whatever I may be working on.
Well, as we might have alluded to in the introduction, I wanted to get down into the weeds of a couple projects that you are currently working on that have to do with real-world implementations of automation. So this is stuff that I know that you've built. I sort of perused your GitHub a little bit, and after a few hours, it came up for air. And a couple projects that I think would be interesting to talk about. So before we focus on those specific projects, it seemed like you were using a pretty common set of tools with all of them. So yeah. Packer, Ansible... Yeah. And a lot of them seem to be around simplifying automation. So is that pretty much your ethos when it comes to what you're putting up on GitHub?
Yeah, absolutely. And like you were saying about Packer, one of the things that I started looking at is I've been using Packer for years. I use Packer and Vagrant and all that. I've been using it for years. And it's a very easy tool. They've made HashiCorp's done a great job at making that tool extremely useful and very flexible and very easy to consume. But what I found, in even from my perspective, was that, for example, talking about Packer, I have a repo that is nothing but a bunch of Packer templates. And it might be things for different distributions of Linux. It might be Windows. It could be firewalls, routers. FreeNAS is another one that might be in there, as well as maybe even some vSphere, like for doing nested vSphere deployments from an ESXi perspective. What I found was, as I've been working on that for over the years, it's very hard to maintain because you always, going back to, you have to have a good structure. Being able to have a good structure where you're not duplicating a lot of the same work. Again, this goes back to the abstractions, right? Having that structure is being able to make sure that when I need to add something new, I don't add complexity to the other things. So what I started dabbling with was, let's take Packer and actually use that really great tool that they built that is very, like I say, simplistic, but let's take the portions of building the templates that generate for the different distributions, Maybe you have different providers that you want to deploy. Maybe you want to send some to vSphere. Maybe some you want to run in Vagrant. Maybe some you want to run on KVM. Maybe some you want to run in DigitalOcean or AWS. Let's take those and wrap them with, in this case, it was Python. Let's actually wrap some Python around it and use some of the same, basically take what you would do from a structure perspective and put it in code and allow people to actually use the tool to where, for example, if I want to generate a bunch of templates, maybe I don't want to do the builds themselves from a Packer perspective, but I just want to generate the templates and validate the templates are good. Well, what this tool does is it actually allows you to define, I know everybody's going to hate what I'm about to say, but I'm going to say it because I actually enjoy it, is it allows you to describe your distributions and some of the elements as a YAML file. And I know, I hear it already. I can hear everybody's going to be throwing stuff at me and they're like, this podcast over. Ethan, why is this the worst podcast? Because we had this idiot on here. So. But what I did was being able to say, okay, I'm going to use this YAML file that describes what I'm trying to do. Now, if you try to do something outside of what is in that YAML file or is documented, now I'm going to be fair, the documentation for that project needs some work. So, but being able to use that YAML file that says, hey, I'm going to do maybe Ubuntu, et cetera, I'm going to define all these different things. And have this tool actually consume the YAML file, it takes care of all of the work that you would normally have to do to build the template that says, hey, my template needs to look like this if I'm doing KVM. My template needs to look like this if I'm doing VirtualBox. My template needs to look like this if I'm doing VMware. My template needs to look like this if I'm doing some other provider. Mm-hmm. We're going to wrap that in, we're going to wrap that logic in the code itself. To where you can say, when I run this command, everything is argument driven, right? From the Python perspective, that says, hey, just generate all these, everything that's in my distros.yaml file, generate the templates and validate that they're good and send them to this directory. So when it does that, it actually goes really quick. It says, reads the YAML file, runs it through the process, and spits out all your templates. So what you've done is basically, this kind of goes to technical debt, right? What you've done is you've taken all of these probably 20 to 30 different directories that you maintain over time from a template perspective, put them into the code itself, into the Python wrapper that says, now that is responsible. So all I need is that Python repository or that Packer Builder repository. And I can then generate all those templates. And that becomes very, very useful in pipelines. So you can actually pull that in as part of your pipeline that says, hey, I'm going to build a bunch of these templates. And maybe I'm building, for example, you might be building a bunch of templates for a vSphere environment. And as part of that pipeline, you just pull that that Packer Builder in and say, I'm actually going to use my own specific distros.yaml file that defines what I'm doing. Now, again, it needs to follow the same format, et cetera, et cetera. But I'm going to pull that in, consume it, generate the files, and actually do the builds as part of the pipeline. Now I can continually grow that process, right? Because there's a lot of other functionality that will be coming to Packer Builder that does a lot of validations and things like that. So it takes that human element. I think that is really hard for some folks because I struggled with it even with Packer initially was, yeah, it's really great for like these one-off things. When I started thinking about these bigger deployments or bigger solutions that I need to use Packer as part of, it becomes very complex, right? Mm-hmm. So that's where Packer Builder came from.
Gotcha. So if I could kind of put together an example of where I think this might be useful. Let's say, like you said, you're building some images for vSphere. Maybe it's like a three image app. So this app is made up of multiple components and you have to put together three different images that'll be deployed. And then you were doing that manually before and your boss comes along and says, oh, by the way, we also want to deploy this in AWS.
Yes.
And now if you're using Packer Builder, you just add AWS as one of the target providers for your deployments and run the tool. And you now have all your templates built out for AWS as well. And if, yep. you know, day three, he comes in, he's like, we're moving to Azure. Everything's going to Azure. You can be like, hey, all right, no problem. I just add Azure and click, click. Now I have my templates for Azure too. At least from an image build perspective, I have now made my image build tool multi-cloud, which I know is right up there with YAML in something that nobody exactly. wants to hear.
Exactly.
But, exactly. Yeah, so I see the thing that we were talking about earlier, that abstract concept of sort of choose your own adventure when you're building tools and starting with an abstraction and then baking it down into specific providers. This is a perfect example of that actually applied.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And part of Packer Builder that's going to be coming, you know, even down the road is more of a pluggable type framework. So we're starting to break things out into more modules now, to where you can start doing things like, you know, obviously if you didn't have, if a provider was not supported, it just wouldn't work, right? Which is part of the reason why it exists, because Packer Builder, the whole idea was not only to simplify it, but it was to ensure that when you got templates and things you were doing, they were consistent. So you were able to say, well, you know, hey, I've got 30 different directories for all these different distributions, and every template looks different because maybe maybe I woke up on the wrong side of the bed that day and I took some shortcuts or I didn't do it as nice. It allows me to be consistent on what I'm stamping out from a template perspective, but not having the support for specific functionality allows the ability for us to add that functionality in a methodical way that makes sense, that it ensures that it's consistent with all the other pieces. Does that make sense?
That makes total sense. So that was one project that caught my eye, and I'm glad you brought it up. The other project that caught my eye, and we talked about this a little bit before we started recording, was guacamole. So I love the name because I love guacamole, but like, we're not talking about mashing up avocados here. There's something, you know, a little more technical involved with guacamole. Yeah, exactly. What is this thing, and why are you using it?
So guacamole, it's kind of funny because, you know, a couple of years ago, I actually just got exposed to guacamole. You know, the whole thing with VDI and things like that, being able to provide access to your desktops, you know, in, you know, from remote, being able to contain those in an isolated environment, et cetera. So what guacamole is actually an Apache project that is open source, that is actually not very easy to get it right, to be quite frank, because they do, when they make releases, like a lot of other open source projects, things tend to break along the way. But one of the things with guacamole that I was trying to do was, I'm trying to remember, it was probably a year or so ago, maybe 2 years now, I actually put an Ansible role together that would actually handle the guacamole installation, that ensured that it was, you know, validated, that it actually has to build from source. So you don't have to do all that stuff manually. So it actually automates all that stuff. It's completely idempotent. For those that may not be aware of what idempotent is to ensure that if I built it once, if I run it again, it doesn't rebuild and overwrite what I just did. So it just ensures that I've already, you know, if I run it over and over and over, that it does not make any adjustments except to configurations that I define. Now, where it becomes very interesting is it's based off of HTML5, I believe. Don't hold me to that. I could be wrong, but I think it is off HTML5. But it's all web-driven, or it's all front-ended. So by default, it uses Tomcat as that web front-end to guacamole. So basically, you define your users. It does tie into like Active Directory and things like that as well. So you can do single sign-on and things like that. But it allows you to add connections for things like RDP, BNC, SSH, some other different things. But those are mainly the ones that I use. So what you do is you have a login, and if you have only one connection that's defined, That's your default. So when you log into the web page, you are defaulted to the only one you may have. So if you had an SSH connection, it would automatically default you and send you to a server that actually is defined for you. Now, if you have, say, an SSH connection as well as an RDP connection, when you log in, you actually get presented with your available connections that you can use, and you click on it, and it takes you to that different connection. So, ironically, I put a post on, on Twitter. I was like, oh, yes, it's the year of the Linux desktop, over guacamole. So basically getting at the idea of not using like a VDI solution using guacamole, but actually it's actually running in DigitalOcean. So what I did was got that working in DigitalOcean, obviously from an automated perspective using Terraform and some other things, being able to get that stood up in DigitalOcean to where I could actually connect to an RDP session that was actually a Ubuntu desktop. So now some might say, well, that's not a big deal. It kind of is, right? Being able to repeat that thing from one perspective is to ensure that it's repeatable. So I've probably deployed this thing 10 times in the last 24 hours to ensure that it provisions from beginning to end. But as I mentioned, Guacamole actually uses Tomcat. So what I've actually implemented as part of that is another GitHub project that I have, which is using Nginx as a load balancer. And it basically allows you to front end your services just using Nginx. So you can front end Guacamole with Nginx, which allows you to add SSL certs and stuff like that a lot easier. So you can actually encrypt that session. So it's a lot of fun. There's more to come on that. I've seen it used in other scenarios. It's a great tool to use, like, for example, if you're providing training that people need access to, maybe desktops, maybe Windows desktops or something like that. It's a great solution from an open source perspective that can provide that virtual desktop experience without having to pay for a real VDI solution, if you will.
Yeah, and I think, you know, as we've seen, remote work is becoming more important recently. Yes. And so being able to create or spin up a VDI solution relatively quickly and without spending a ton of money might be somewhat useful to folks out there. Well, as we start to wrap things up for the episode, one of the things that we ask our guests to do for the audience is to come up with a few key takeaways, whether those are action items, core principles to keep in mind, or design recommendations. So if you could distill just like maybe three key takeaways for our audience, what would those things be?
So one thing that I would take, I'm going to have a hard time coming up with three maybe, but one of the biggest things that just off of our conversation over this last little bit is, number one, I need to go validate I haven't left a bunch of technical debt.
Okay.
Because number one, the real key takeaway is make sure to document everything that you're doing. Make sure that if you are leveraging open source, that it does make sense. It will break. So make sure that you are absolutely doing your due diligence in not just testing it one time. Test it over and over and over, different times of the day. I've seen scenarios where I'll test something 10 times the day before, the next day it just breaks. You're like, what the hell just happened? Guess what? There was a Python package that was updated, or maybe there was a MariaDB update that came out the night before that had a bug in it that all of a sudden you've just exposed yourself to failure. So make sure that not only are you documenting, that you're always testing on what you do, and also to make sure that you're doing things in a model that is consistent. There are different things that you can do. We'll talk about some of those other things at another time, because I'm going to go down another rabbit hole if I don't be careful here. but being able to be consistent, I guess, is the real thing. So I don't know if that was three. I don't even know if that answered your question, but those are the things that Ethan made me very aware of And made me make sure to do a self-check.
I think we're probably at like 3.5 because I got don't leave technical debt, document, use open source when it makes sense. Only when it makes sense. Be consistent and test repeatedly. So that's like, that's a bunch of key takeaways. We might be up to 6. I don't know.
Well, there you go. See, I did.
Well, Larry, if folks want to know more about you and what you're up to, where are the best places to follow you or find your presentations or, you know, posts?
So you can follow me on Twitter. I'm pretty quiet on Twitter, but my Twitter handle is at Mr. Ellie Smith Jr. And those for you that are like, what the hell is that? It is literally just Mr. Larry E. Smith Jr. So there's nothing creative other than that. Probably GitHub, is probably the best place to keep up with, things that I'm working on that can be public. Blog, very minimal. I don't blog a whole lot anymore because most of my blogging happens in GitHub, but my blog site is, everythingshouldbevirtual.com.
All right. Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Larry, for taking the time out of your day to talk to us about automation. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, guys. Much appreciated as well.
And virtual high fives to you, our audience, for tuning in. If you have suggestions for future shows, we'd love to hear them. Hit either us up on Twitter at EC Banks or at Ned1313, or fill out the form on my fancy website, nedinthecloud.com. If you've got a way cool cloud product that you want to share with our audience of IT professionals, why not become a Day 2 Cloud sponsor? You'll reach several thousand listeners, all of whom have problems to solve. Maybe your product fixes their problem, but you know what? They'll never know unless you tell them about your amazing solution. You can find out more at packetpushers.net/sponsorship. Until then, just remember, cloud is what happens while IT is making other plans.